Sup, you beautiful bastards. Hope you're having a fantastic Friday. Welcome back to the Philip DeFranco Show. And if you're new here, on Fridays, we do things a little bit differently. On Fridays, I try to cover stories I wanted to get to earlier this week, but for time reasons or whatever, we weren't able to get to it, also including more viewer-requested stories. And so with that said, let's jump into it. And the first thing we're going to talk about today is something that's really interesting to me because there is a lot of backlash around something that we actually included yesterday and today in Awesome. And that is, there are a lot of people angry about the new show Insatiable, which is coming out on Netflix starring Debbie Ryan. And if you only saw the quick clip, essentially here's the setup for the story. You have this girl who's having a horrible time in high school. A lot of it seems to be connected to her weight. They call her Fatty Patty. She ends up getting punched in the face. She has to have her jaw wired shut. She loses a ton of weight, and oh my gosh, now look at her. And now Patty has so many options. What will she do?
Now, I could be the former fatty who turned into a brain. Or an athlete. Or a princess.
No, I'd rather have revenge.
And then it appears she tries to get back at everyone. And following this trailer coming out, getting a good bit of traction, there was a good amount of backlash saying that this was fat shaming. And in came the tweets like, "This is a good example of why I grew up insecure and thought I would never be loved because of my size. Give us a story where the fat girl stays fat, struggles, but learns to accept her body and overcome societal standards." Another saying it promotes fat shaming, teaches young people that if you don't eat, you'll become skinny and desirable, romanticizes revenge fantasy, shows that you're only deserving of love and popularity if you fall into society's definition of beauty. Another tweeting at Alyssa Milano directly, she also stars in the movie, saying, "Really? So she wasn't able to take revenge until she was conventionally attractive? This is disgusting. You are the face of the women's movement, and this? Shame on you." To which Alyssa Milano replied, "We are not shaming Patty. We are addressing through comedy the damage that occurs from fat shaming. I hope that clears it up. Also, this article does a good job of explaining it more." And then linking to a Teen Vogue article about the new series, Debbie Ryan, who of course is the star of the show, also linking out to it and pointing out a specific section where it says, "When she returns to school, everyone's stunned by her physical change. Problematic? You bet. After all, if someone's treatment of you is rooted in how your body looks, that says a lot about them, not you. Attuned to that, Patty sets out on a quest to make everyone pay for how they treated her, even if you really should just let karma deal with the wrongdoers and it's good, sweet time." The article also goes on to point out that once she gets a taste for revenge, she just wants more. Based on it being a dark comedy, it looks like she goes way too far. And ultimately where I land on this, I have two thoughts, but they're both on the same side. And where I'll start is, one, anytime there's this outrage backlash story or revolving, especially around a trailer, my reaction is, let me watch the series or the movie and then I'll react. Right at this point, because of the trailer, we kind of know the premise, we know a few of the pieces, but we don't know the full messaging, how successful they are in conveying that message. And also, I think it's important when we're talking about pieces of entertainment, whether it be a book, a series, a movie, or whatever, an experience in that is not supposed to be representative of everything or an ideal. It is a story. And that's why, too, I'm actually very excited about this series. If you're new to my show, you might not know that my weight over the past 10 years that I've been on YouTube has fluctuated. My actual healthy weight is around 180, 190. A few months ago, I was 245. Right now, I'm 210. But way, way, way back in the olden times when I was in high school, I was a very, 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 very big boy. I was at like 260 to 270. And at that time, I was treated pretty horribly. There was such self-hatred inside of me. So much so that I have almost no photos from that time. One of the only photos I was able to find was this one. I don't even know if this was me at my heaviest, but it just gives you a kind of a picture. And kind of feeding into the story of how shitty and petty and horrible people are, the way that I found that photo, someone on a forum that's essentially dedicated to just talking shit on people posted that as a way to just kind of make fun of me, which also makes no sense because all that shows is how far I've come. So thank you, I guess. But after high school, I went from my heaviest to that 180 that I was talking about, and it also filled me with a lot of hate. Because what I found when I lost all of this weight is all of a sudden people who either didn't care about me or had treated me horribly before all of a sudden were very nice and gave me attention. And while part of it made me feel good about myself, what it primarily did was it filled me with hate. Because whether I was 270 or I was 180, I was the same person, but now I was being treated differently, like I was more of an equal or attractive. I knew that I was just as worthy of attention and love before than I was then, but why did no one else? Right, I get that mindset, and to anyone dealing with their own weight issues, I mean, know that. You are worthy of love and human decency right now, and because of whatever your size is, you do not deserve to be bullied and targeted. Right, I'm just throwing that out there because that should be a generally understood thing. And so for me, I very much relate to the beginning of the story, and I did not need to lose the weight to do whatever else I did in my life, but having gone through a certain experience and seen how people treated me differently, that definitely opened my eyes and gave me a different life experience. And understand, I'm not saying this from a point of, well, look how beautiful I am now. I'm an after photo comparatively to where I was a few months ago, but I'm still very much the before photo for where I want to be. But like the story told on this show, like my personal life, That is just one story. And ultimately, I think people saying that this show is going to be harmful in some way, I think at the very least, they're jumping the gun. Wait till you see the full thing. You might feel the same. Maybe there's some stuff in there that just confirms exactly what you thought. That is true. But it is a piece of entertainment. It is a piece of dark comedy. And I'm excited to see it. Although, I will admit, I am a little biased because I love revenge story fantasies. Like, one of my favorite books of all time, Count of Monte Cristo. But that said, I will pass the question off to you. Do you think that the people that are speaking out about this show, that they are in the right or no? They're jumping the gun? Are they being ridiculous? Is this an example of outrage culture? I'd love to know any and all thoughts. Also, let me know if you have specifically had issues with your weight and how you feel about it. I'd love to know. But from that, I want to share some stuff I love today. And today in Awesome, brought to you by Postmates. And Postmates, if you don't know, is the fantastic delivery on demand app. You want something from your favorite restaurant, store? Open up the app, boom, they will deliver it to your house, your work, your wherever. And there's also been no better time to try it out for the first time. It's now in 100 more cities. And two, if you just go to postdefranco.com, you download Postmates, you open it up, go ahead and enter in offer code PhillyD, and they will give you $100 in free delivery credit. And the first bit of awesome today is if you want to 100% filled in today, we have a brand new bonus video for you. This time it's a news dive into privacy versus content creation in public. I highly recommend you check it out. Then we got the news yesterday that season 7 of Clone Wars is a thing. It's happening. I'm incredibly excited. I'm a little disappointed that they're releasing it via Disney streaming service. I'm gonna probably one and done that thing. But yes, I am so excited. Side note, if you are even just remotely into Star Wars, I highly recommend you watch through it. I know for some people they're like, oh, a cartoon. It's great. Side note, if you're a fan of Rebels, is it that good to watch all the way through? I watched the first season, enjoyed it, but then I kind of lost track. Let me know, but I'm so pumped about this. Then, in other awesome that I'm just as excited about, we got a trailer for Glass. I hope that M. Night keeps his streak going. For a while there, you would get audible groans from people when you were in a theater and a trailer revealed that he was associated, but I feel like after The Visit, he's been pretty solid. Then we had Joji and Rich Brian on Hot Ones. We had Video Game Donkey covering the game we've all been waiting for, Bubsy 3D. Ted Ed gave us a little History versus Augustus. We got the story trailer for the new Spider-Man game, and it actually looks amazing. As well as the trailer for I Still See You. As well as the trailer for Welcome to Marwen. And if you want to see the full versions of everything I just shared, the secret link of the day, really anything I talk about today, links as always are in the description down below. And then let's talk about Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats in the news. We've talked about him several times over the past week since Donald Trump mentioned his name during the press conference with Vladimir Putin. And of course, during the now infamous 2 minutes where Donald Trump mentions that Dan Coats says we think it's Russia. Well, in news that may be another step towards me eventually calling him former Director of National Intelligence, he did an interview. And it's a really interesting watch, especially because as he is being interviewed live, you see his genuine reaction to the news that Vladimir Putin is to visit the White House.
Say, we have some breaking news. The White House has announced on Twitter that Vladimir Putin is coming to the White House in the fall.
Say that again.
You... Vladimir Putin coming
to the... Did I hear
you? Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be special.
I will say for me personally, I had a very similar reaction, but I'm also not the Director of National Intelligence. The fact that that appears to be how he's learning about it and how he's trying to comment on it without.
Wow.
And there are a few other key moments in this interview. One, he says he doesn't know what happened between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin in their private meeting. When asked if Donald Trump could have been recorded, he said that risk is always there. When asked how Trump prefers his intelligence meetings, he said,
he likes it orally. He likes examples. We use models. We use charts. We use a number of things.
Regarding the Oval Office meeting between Trump and former Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, during which Trump shared classified information, Coates said that was, quote,
probably not the best thing to do.
Also saying in Helsinki he wished that Trump had made a different statement, saying it's undeniable that the Russians are taking a lead on this. But in my opinion, one of the key standout quotes was when he was specifically speaking on Vladimir Putin, and he said,
I think anybody who thinks that Vladimir Putin doesn't have his stamp on everything that happens in Russia is misinformed. It is very clear that virtually nothing happens there of any kind of consequence that Vladimir Putin doesn't know about or hasn't ordered. I think we're pretty sure about that.
And the reason that's such a standout moment is something we talked about yesterday. The way that Donald Trump said that Vladimir Putin is responsible was very kind of open, saying that Vladimir Putin is responsible for what happens in Russia, like Donald Trump is responsible for what happens in the United States. Right, very soft, very disconnected. There's really not a lot of ownership there. But now we're hearing this from Dan Coats. Also connected to the story in a separate quickie regarding foreign interference. Yesterday we saw Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein announcing that the Justice Department plans to notify the public, American companies, and private organizations organizations when foreign entities are targeting the U.S. political process. Adding, the Department of Justice investigates and prosecutes malign foreign influence activity that violates federal criminal law. Some critics argue against prosecuting people who live in foreign nations that are unlikely to extradite their citizens. That is a short-sighted view. And in fact, at that same event, the Aspen Security Forum, Tom Burr, Microsoft's Vice President for Customer Safety and Trust, he said that his team has already uncovered evidence that three U.S. candidates running for election in 2018 have been targeted. This by the Russia Intelligence Agency, formerly known as GRU. So there's that. And then let's talk about this lawsuit situation with MGM Resorts International. Now, as you might remember, on October 1st, 2017, there was a mass shooting in Las Vegas. And MGM Resorts owns both Mandalay Bay, where the shooter was shooting from, and the Route 91 Harvest Festival venue, where 58 people were killed and hundreds of others were injured. And the massive news over the past week was that MGM Resorts International filed federal lawsuits in Nevada and California against more than 1,000 victims of the shooting. And of course, most people's initial reaction was, what the fuck? How are you going to sue the victims of a mass shooting? And it appears they are doing so in an effort to avoid liability. According to MGM, since the shooting, more than 2,500 people have brought lawsuits or threatened to file lawsuits against them. While MGM is not suing for money, they are suing so that they don't have to give money. And in their lawsuit, the company argues that it cannot be held liable for deaths, injuries, or other damages stemming from the attack, adding that any claims against them must be dismissed and that the plaintiffs have no liability of any kind to defendants. And their argument relies on a 2002 federal act that extends liability protection to any company that uses, quote, anti-terrorism technology or services that can help prevent and respond to mass violence. And in their specific case, they argue that the security vendor they hired for Route 91, Contemporary Services Corp, they were protected from liability because its services had been certified by the Department of Homeland Security for, quote, protecting against and responding to acts of mass injury and destruction. And so the lawsuit argues that this protection also extends to MGM since they hired that security company. And if the judge ended up agreeing with them, that would mean future civil suits against them would not be viable. So that brings up the question, what the hell is the Safety Act? Well, it stands for Support Anti-Terrorism by Fostering Effective Technology Act of 2002. And the act was passed just more than a year, but still in the shadow of September 11th, 2001. The purpose of the law in general was to protect manufacturers developing technologies that could help guard against future terror attacks, additionally protecting companies that provided services to defend against and respond to threats. And a key point in the Safety Act is that it defines terrorism as an unlawful act inside the United States that causes mass destruction, injury, or other loss. And the reason I talk about the language and I say that this is notable is because even the FBI has not deemed this a terrorist act. But that's also because the FBI defines domestic terrorism very specifically. An act perpetrated by individuals and or groups inspired by or associated with primarily US-based movements that espouse extreme ideologies of a political, religious, social, racial, or environmental nature. But as of right now, according to the FBI, the gunman had no clear motive, also never expressed ideologies that fit the FBI definition of domestic terror, whereas once again, the Safety Act is more broad. And that's why the lawsuit reads, there is no requirement in the statute or regulations of an ideological motive or objective for the attack for it to meet the requirements of the Safety Act. And a big part of this situation is whether this should be handled in federal court or state court. MGM has argued that it is federal, saying Congress provided that the federal courts were the correct place for such litigation relating to incidents of mass violence like this one where security services approved by the Department of Homeland Security were provided. Later adding, years of drawn-out litigation and hearings are not in the best interest of victims, the community, and those still healing. But on the other side, you have the attorneys who are suing on the behalf of victims, saying it is a state court issue. Las Vegas attorney Robert Eaglet arguing that because MGM is a Nevada company, that any lawsuit against them belongs in state court. Adding that MGM's grounds for litigation are obscure, going on to say that MGM's decision to file a complaint in federal court was a blatant display of judge shopping that quite frankly verges on unethical. Adding, I've never seen a more outrageous thing where they sue the victims in an effort to find a judge they like. And attorney Craig Island, who also represents several other victims, agrees, saying MGM is trying to beat these people to the courthouse and declare that they have no rights. The proper venue for this is Nevada State Court, plain and simple under the law. And of course, when it comes to a situation like this, it's not just about federal court, it's not just about state court, there is also the court of public opinion. And since this story came out, there has been mass outrage with many people calling for boycotts. We've seen hashtag boycott MGM Resorts trending, people providing a list of the hotels that they own, people saying this move by MGM goes against human decency, it's ultra disgusting corporate behavior. And as far as where I land on this story, I will say I'm a little split on it, although I am leaning more one way. I will say on the surface level, looks horrible for MGM. It looks like they're attacking the victims of a mass shooting. But then the business side of my brain goes, well, they're not really attacking. They're not seeking money. They're trying to see whether they could be held liable or not in a federal court. So the move is proactive, preemptive, defensive in nature for them. They're trying to see sooner than later if they can be shielded in a certain court and then make it so that the people that were the victims can only sue CSC, which is Contemporary Services Corporation, which is the company that provided the security. Right, because under the Safety Act that we talked about, if it goes to that specific court, only the seller, CSC, could be named in a lawsuit and not the buyer, MGM. And so based on the positioning and understanding I have at this point, that's why I don't necessarily think that MGM is evil here. That said, of course, as the situation develops, I'll continue picking through it, and I want to pass the question off to you. What's your takeaway? And also a question specifically to the lawsuit, do you think MGM should be held liable? The shooter is able to get a ridiculous number of weapons through the hotel to the room, shooting from one of their properties to another. Do you personally think MGM should be held liable? Yes? No? Why not? Let me know. And then finally, let's talk about the incredibly important and horrifying story coming out of Nicaragua. Now, back in April, you might remember we covered the deadly clashes that occurred when the Nicaraguan government announced changes to the Social Security system regarding pensions. And at that time, we mentioned that while the people initially took to the streets to protest these changes, the protests eventually morphed into a just general opposition to President Daniel Ortega. And though that specific plan was eventually dropped, Ortega's leadership and a suppression of public protest provoked calls for him to step down. And since then, the violence between pro-Ortega forces and demonstrators has continued with an estimated 300 killed. In fact, many reports calling these the bloodiest protests in Nicaragua since the country's civil war ended in 1990. And the government has accused the protesters of trying to mount a coup, and in the past few weeks have begun actively suppressing ongoing demonstrations. Last week, we saw Ortega rejecting calls for his resignation, telling thousands of supporters that protesters demanding he leave office should, quote, seek the vote of the people if they want to govern. The weekend of July 7th and 8th, pro-government militias clashed with protesters in Jinotepe and Diriamba, two cities south of the capital in what was the deadliest day of the protest. There, they ransacked churches and reportedly left an estimated 38 people dead in the area. 31 were believed to be anti-government protesters, 4 police officers, and 3 members of pro-government groups. And over the past week, paramilitaries have continued to sweep through several cities, breaking down barricades and deadly battles as they try to regain control. We saw last Thursday thousands of people march through the streets of Managua, the country's capital, for a peaceful protest. The next day, a nationwide strike began as businesses shut their doors, people cleared the streets. This after calls from opposition leaders and society groups who wanted Ortega to resign and to stage early elections. And by the afternoon, pro-government militias reportedly set out to break up the student rebellion at the National Autonomous University of Nicaragua, which is widely considered the strongest protest holdout in the capital. Protesters at that campus had barricaded themselves there for 2 months in protest against Ortega. Reportedly, some students were carrying firearms, but most reportedly carried weapons like rocks, spikes, and homemade mortars. And reportedly, once the shooting started, they were quickly overrun and forced out of the area. And students fearing for their lives sent farewell messages to friends and family from behind their barricades. With one in particular, a Facebook Live video of a woman speaking to her mother going viral.
Mama! Mama, perdoname! Salí a defender mi patria. Te amo, oíste.
Now, during a more than 15-hour siege, around 200 university students and others took cover inside of the Divine Mercy Church. The students, at least 2 priests, 2 doctors, neighbors, volunteers, journalists, they were all trapped inside by gunfire coming from pro-government groups surrounding the compound. And during that standoff, at least 2 students were killed and around a dozen were injured. And while all of this was happening, 2 reverends were inside on their cell phones calling Nicaragua's Catholic clergy, asking for help and to help negotiate a peaceful resolution with the government. And at one point, they even called into a live radio broadcast and appealed for help, saying the students had left the university barricade, so there was no reason for the government to keep shooting. And on Saturday morning, students, protesters, and journalists all walked down after Catholic church leaders negotiated their release with pro-government gunmen. And as far as how an official government news site referred to these events, El Diese Nueve described the students as terrorists and criminals who had attacked a caravan of Sandinistas earlier in the day and then burned buildings on campus as they fled, and also publishing pictures of the weapons they found at the church after the students were taken away. On Sunday, we saw the violence continue as government forces launched more intense raids in 3 rebellious towns south of the capital. Masaya has been at the center of the protests since they first erupted 3 months ago. There, protesters demanding the resignation of President Ortega set up roadblocks, barricades both inside the city and on the roads leading to it. In response, the government launched Operation Cleanup. They tried to remove the barricades, retake control of the city. And here, there were claims from residents and rights groups saying that when they tried to stop them, pro-government forces would attack them. And here, citizens were warned by human rights groups to take shelter in their homes. There were reports that there were sharpshooters in the area. Alvaro Gomez, a local resident, said, "We are being attacked by the national police and paramilitaries armed with AK-47s and machine guns in our indigenous neighborhood of Monimbo. We are resisting with homemade bombs and stones." And according to reports, this operation, Operation Cleanup, left at least 10 people dead and around 20 people injured. And according to the Nicaraguan Association for Human Rights, the dead included 4 police members and 6 civilians, 2 of them children. And according to the association, had one of the children that was killed was a 10-year-old girl who was shot in the stomach and died due to lack of medical treatment. And also, in a statement on Sunday, Nicaraguan police said that one police officer was kidnapped, tortured, and killed by, quote, "terrorist groups who stay in trenches in the city of Masaya." But then, oddly, they also did not comment on the other deaths that were being reported. Then came Monday, where we saw reports that families were burying the dead. By this point, the U.S. State Department, the United Nations, and 12 Latin American nations all condemned the violence on Monday. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert saying, "Every additional victim of this violence and intimidation campaign further undermines Ortega's legitimacy. Early, free, fair, and transparent elections are the best path back to democracy and respect for human rights in Nicaragua." In the UN statement reading, "The use of lethal force is not only unacceptable, but is also in itself an obstacle to obtaining a political solution to the current crisis." Then on Tuesday, Nicaraguan police and armed pro-government civilians laid siege in Manimbo. Reportedly, the government's forces started to advance on the neighborhood before dawn. In response, we saw the youth in Manimbo firing homemade mortars. But by the afternoon, the pro-government forces had taken control and began to remove roadblocks set up by the opposition. An early report said that 3 people were killed in the fighting. On Wednesday, we saw the Organization of American States adopt a resolution condemning the violence. The resolution passed with 21 votes in favor and 3 against. The 3 against were Nicaragua, Venezuela, and St. Vincent and the Grenadines. We saw Vice President Mike Pence tweeting about the OAS decision, saying, "Proud to see OAS take a strong stand against state-sponsored violence in Nicaragua and vote to condemn the Ortega regime's brutal acts of repression. Our hemisphere is watching and raising its voice in support of the Nicaraguan people. The violence must end now." So there's all of that, and like I said at the beginning of this, where we are right now is in the last 3 months, now up to more than 300 are dead. As far as why it has been so deadly, human rights groups say it's because of government forces, paramilitary groups, saying specifically they've been using excessive force, they've been using live bullets and sharpshooters against demonstrators.
Esto es con lo que nos está matando. Nosotros estamos respondiendo y reaccionando nada más con bombas artesanales, pero esto no va a matar a un policía. Esto sí va a matar a un poblador.
There have also been allegations that members of security forces are not allowing the wounded to be taken to hospitals. But as far as the government is concerned, they deny the violence is one-sided, pointing to the use of homemade mortars by the protesters as evidence that the security forces were under attack. Also, a number of police officers, as we've mentioned, have been among those killed. And so the government is pointing to these instances and saying that these protesters are actually terrorists. And all of this right now is ramping up at a very significant time in Nicaragua. Yesterday was the 39th anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution. It's a day referred to as Liberation Day, and it's also notable because Ortega was part of that revolution, helping lead the uprising, and here we are today, 39 years later. But with all of that said, as far as what happens from here, we're gonna have to wait to see. We are seeing some international responses, some condemnation, but ultimately, there are people in the country that are being killed. And as of right now, it appears that there is no end in sight, that this will continue to drag on. And that's where I'm going to end today's show. And of course, remember, this is the PDS. It is not just a show, it is a conversation. So whether it be the last story, the first one, anything in between, let me know what you're thinking in those comments down below. Also, remember, if you like this video, you like the way that I talk about the news, hit that like button. If you're new here, hit that subscribe button, ring that bell to turn on notifications. Don't always work, but they can help make sure you don't miss these daily shows, which actually, if you did miss the last Philip DeFranco show, you want to catch up, click or tap right there to watch that. Or maybe you're in the mood for something lighter, you can watch the newest vlog right here. But that said, of course, as always, my name's Philip DeFranco. You've just been filled in. I love yo faces, and I'll see you Monday.